The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this week, we're going to be talking to a very special guest. His name is Dan Ely. He's originally from Surrey in the United Kingdom. And we'll be talking about his experiences here in Colombia, because really, his story is one to behold. And it is, as you can imagine, for those of you who have some idea of what Dan's story is, it's a triumph of the human spirit. Dan was down here in Colombia, working at an international school in the southern city of Cali before he experienced a tragic accident, which was, as you can imagine, life-changing. But if you're ever having, you know, if you ever have any doubts about life and what you're here for, you could possibly talk to Dan, because now get in touch with him through the Dan Ely Foundation, because he set up a foundation to help people who are, less well off than those of us in very, accommodating circumstances. And his story is incredible. I'm not going to make any bones about it. It really is incredible. And we hope that this story that he's going to share with us on the line from Cali in just a few minutes will be able to inspire others to do and to get involved with altruistic projects out there that can improve the lives of others. I mean, that's the deal, isn't it, at the end of it? And a country such as Colombia really needs this. It really needs this, especially in this period of time as we're going to enter into a sort of reconciliation phase post-March, probably, given the peace dialogues that have been going on since November 2012, and they look to be coming to an end, hopefully to sign a lasting and sustainable peace accord with the FARC guerrillas. So that's over 50 years of war. How is Colombia going to come to terms with this? It remains to be seen. Of course, the language is changing. Of course, we're saying peace dialogues, peace accords, but it'll be then not post-conflict, it'll be post-accord speak. And those of us who know about this will be very careful as we tiptoe around these subjects, because it's a very touchy, touchy subject. But I don't want to digress, because we're talking about Dan Ely, and we'll be talking to him on the line from Cali just when it comes through. It is an incredible story of the triumph of the human spirit, about how you can change your life, obviously through situations out of his hands, but how you can change your life to improve the lives of people around you and across the globe. And it really, it's an inspiring story. And I hope to hear from some of you in the future about this story. I know that I'm picking up further listeners across the world, but this story should hopefully inspire more of you to get involved in altruistic projects. Again, check out the Dan Ely Foundation. Please, if you're feeling generous, benevolent, send some money his way, because his more than 90% of the funding for his projects, and more than 90% of the money sent for the funding of the projects goes to the projects themselves, which you and I both know is a very high percentage, especially when it comes to foundations and so on. So without further ado, of course, I just say get in touch. That's columbiacalling@gmail.com, columbiacallingradio.com. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. Check out the pages. Get in touch if you want to hear about anything in particular, or if you want to hear from someone again, if you've liked any of the previous 126 episodes that we've been broadcasting out here on the Overseas Radio Network. But without further ado, we will take a short break and be back with Dan Ely in Cali talking to us about, well, his life, his story, and how his life changed. So I've been Richard McColl. This is Columbia Calling. Don't go away. Thank you. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl, and we're here in Bogota. Well, I'm here in Bogota in the studio, my office here overlooking the Septima. You know, it's been a heat wave in Bogota. Well, for Bogota standards. But this week, without further ado, I'd like to introduce a very special guest who's Dan Ely, who originally from Godalming in Surrey, but a great Colombiaphile. And I want to talk about Dan. Dan had you could say definitely a life-changing event in 2010, which he will talk about because I am not equipped to talk about, but he will talk about definitely later on in the show and we'll get into that. But I want to talk about Dan. I want to introduce him here and say, you know, how did you end up here in Colombia for the first time prior to 2010?
Wow. Okay. So going back a few years now, yes. 2009, I had been living and working for a couple of charities in Central America, mm-hmm. One called Casa Alianza in Guatemala City, which works with street children. And another, then after a year there, I went to El Salvador and worked for another charity involving youngsters in communities where there's gang activity. So having studied psychology, this was something, youth work was something that really drew me. And I'd traveled, backpacked around Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia in 2005, fell in love with South America, as many people do, and wanted to come back and actually combine that with working and contributing something. So I spent a couple of years between 2006 to 2008 working in Central America, and then put my backpack on again and kicked through Central America, down to Panama City, and then I flew from Panama City to Cartagena.
You were clearly bitten by the South America bug, the Latin America bug, which, you know, I claim to be bitten as well 16 years later. I'm fascinated that you spent that time in Guatemala City, because I lived there for a year in 1998-1999, and I was aware of Casa Alianza. I did know of their job, so that's very cool.
That's interesting. Yeah, they're a very well-known charity actually in Central America, probably the best known one that works with street children specifically. And that was a really kind of eye-opening, formative experience for me. And actually, and it is related to why I'm doing what I'm doing today.
Mm-hmm. So yes, and we will definitely get into that, because of course, I mean, these are formative years, and actually my year again, 98-99 in Guatemala was my formative year. It was like my year off from university, you know, the third year language, and that's it. I never looked back after that. I almost didn't go back to university. I was like, no, I'm gonna stay. But fortunately, mm-hmm. I was taught back into finishing my degree and then looking for something else out there. But so you came down, and then after these experiences in Casa Alianza and backpacking, and basically deepening your love for the region, I guess you ended up in Cali.
I did. I'd spent 5 weeks traveling around Colombia. We've gone to the Lost City in Santa Marta, Cartagena, Medellin, Bogota, Salento, many of the most beautiful and well-known places in Colombia. Mm-hmm. Then down to Cali, and really was just taken in by Cali, actually. Mm-hmm. the vibrant atmosphere, the kind of outdoor culture, the nightlife, the warmth, both of the climate and the people. And it was really it really drew me in, and I thought, this is somewhere I'm going to come back and live.
Fantastic.
And And that's kind of where the story starts. I did then continue my travels. I went back to the UK for summer, and I took up a job working in a bilingual college called Colegio Bennett, and started working there in August 2009.
Fantastic. So I mean, and that, but all with the aim of returning to Colombia.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, with the aim of one day trying to get back into charity work, whether it be kind of volunteer work in my extra hours, or actually to try and find a more full time job working with perhaps a British NGO in in Cali.
Yeah, definitely. And so you came back. Did you come back under the auspices of an NGO, or did you come back under your own steam?
No, I mean, I came back under the auspices of the college that had employed me. They'd arranged my visa. They'd have paid for my flight. So that, I mean, they'd already kind of taken me under their wing and arranged accommodation. So as soon as I arrived, I was taken to my flat. And next day I started work. So yeah, it was quite a quick turnaround, really. Just a couple of months in the UK over summer, and then straight back to Colombia.
Fantastic. This was fantastic. Now we will move on. We have to move on to the, you know, this life-changing event. And we've addressed sensitive topics here on Colombia Calling before, but principally about sort of children who are adopted and then, you know, elsewhere and are looking for their roots. So Colombian children who's been taken off to Iowa, Wisconsin or whatever, and, you know, and now coming back in their 30s to find out of where they come from, a little bit about their past and their roots. But this, your story, is far different from that. And again, like I said, I'm ill-equipped. All I'll say is it was New Year's Day 2010.
That's right.
So can you talk us through a little bit?
Yep. A couple of friends of mine and myself had traveled to Leticia on New Year's Eve, and we'd just actually spent the last week in the Feria de Cali. So we were kind of in down mode.
Okay.
You know, with the idea of recovering and then getting our energies back to do a big jungle adventure. On New Year's Day, we were out and we were taken in really by the carnival atmosphere in this little town in the jungle, and met some local people, as you do very easily in Colombia. And they'd invited us to this, what can only be described, I suppose, as an outdoor lido, like a sort of natural lido dug into the ground, quite crudely, you know, dark water, nothing outstanding or special at all. And so we accompanied them in a taxi. It's about 8 kilometers outside of Leticia. We arrived, my friends went straight into the water and started swimming. I was more reluctant because I think I was chatting to some people and I didn't really fancy sort of taking my clothes off and getting wet. But in the end, I was beckoned in and I went running into the water, much like you do, much like as if you were on the beach and you went running to dive into the waves. And I took what I thought was a flat dive. And that actually is the last memory I have as an able-bodied person. Now then, I was unconscious for a few minutes. I don't know who rescued me. But when I opened my eyes and looked up at the sky, I realized that some people had taken me out of the water. They'd put me on the bank. And I looked up at it. There was a girl looking down who I didn't recognize at me, saying the ambulance is on its way. And I tried to get up thinking, well, you know, whatever for, I can't feel any pain. I'm not concussed. And then as I tried to get up, I realized I couldn't move at all. And that was the biggest fright of my life.
Yeah, I imagine the shock entering the reality.
Yeah, and then actually remembering the dive and thinking, yes, okay, I know what I've done here. And it's not going to be an easy time ahead, especially when you know you're in the middle of nowhere. So, yeah, you know, quickly the ambulance arrived, fortunately, and I was taken to a clinic in Leticia, very basic. And we phoned my family. Phone my which was obviously quite a shock for them on New Year's Day. And then my friend called the insurance company, and that didn't go so well either. They weren't that keen on the idea of transferring me, and I spent two very difficult days fighting for my life in a very basic clinic in Leticia.
Yeah. But so I'm assuming you hit a shallow bank under the water or something.
Yeah, because I've just been back there last summer, not wanting to ruin the story, but I found out that it's actually plaid with wood like trunks at the bottom of this, which is quite an odd thing, and it's quite slippery underfoot. So obviously, had it been sand or dirt, I can't imagine that the impact would have been strong enough to do what it did. But I learned that it actually was a wooden clad sort of base to this this pool pond, if you like. Unfortunately, so that kind of thought, okay, now I understand why the impact was so strong, and I broke a couple of bones, fractured a couple of bones in my neck, C5, C6, and they splintered, and the bones went into my medulla, my spinal column, and as such, you know, the resulting paralysis.
Yes, and so explain to our listeners a little bit, please. What would the resulting injury now? So you're in a wheelchair now, but you're paralyzed.
I'm quadriplegic.
Okay.
I'm what's called tetraplegic complete. So that's a C5, C6. Oh no, sorry, C4, C5. So there's two areas of there's two lesions, which means that I've been able to recover some arm movement, as you can see.
I can see here, yes.
But for 6 months, really, I couldn't move anything below my neck.
Wow.
And it was kind of, that was the prognosis was, you know, this is it for life. Mm-hmm. You're probably going to drive a wheelchair with your chin. And, you know, sometimes there's no better incentive than a doctor telling you, you can't do this and you can't do that to go out there and prove him wrong. I've been able to make massive improvements, and I can now feed myself. Although I can't feel anything below the elbows, I can, using splints, I can feed myself with my left hand, which is the stronger arm, and the right arm I can use my laptop a little bit with and drink water with through a tube. So,
terrible accident, of course. And if those of you out there listening, you see, Ben is actually Dan is actually in Cali at the moment, and we're talking over Skype, and he's a little bit unwell, a little bit under the weather. So any coughing,
just a tad
under the weather, but you know, these things, but we're so pleased to have you on the show, because you know, it's sharing it, it's such a personal and terrifying experience. You're able-bodied, you know, as far as I can tell, and reading the blogs and the Dan Ely Foundation and the pages and everything, is that you are a real adventurer now. But you haven't let this stop the adventure, because look at it, you're back in Cali. I mean, this is not an ordinary thing. You're back up there in Cali, and we're talking about these success stories that you've made, the Dan Ely Foundation, which is pretty fantastic. But let's, as we wind down this first section of the show, I just want to, can you give a little bit of a description of the clinic, you know, down there in Leticia, in this border town in the Amazon?
Yeah, it was a two-bed clinic, and I was taken there, and because it was New Year's Day, I remember a lot of drunk men coming in and lying in the bed next to me temporarily while they got stitched up. And and it was, I remember kind of actually shouting and screaming and sort of saying, look, I've just sort of thrown my life away. It really was quite awful, to be honest. I knew that I'd broken my neck, and I wasn't sure if I would make a recovery. So now I was given, because once the paralysis sets into your intercostal muscles, you lose the ability to inhale and exhale, so breathing becomes the big issue. And very quickly on the first day, after a few hours, I sort of started to struggle to breathe. I remember this big black rusty oxygen tank which they had there, which they got out, and they'd connected some oxygen. I had some tubes in my nose and a mask over my mouth, but I couldn't breathe in the oxygen, because actually I couldn't move my chest.
Yeah.
So although the oxygen's circulating around your mouth, And then the next day I started to sort of feel very delirious, very weak, very dizzy, and there was still no news from the insurance company. I knew that my family and the British Embassy were fighting to get me saved in the background, but as far as I was aware, there was still no way out. Then the second night, which was the last night I spent there, I was left in the company of one quite elderly nurse. And I remember I was very tired and sedated, and I looked up and I could see this figure at the end of the bed. And as I squinted my eyes and looked closer, I could see that there was a lady praying.
Huh.
And I thought, crikey, you know, she must think I'm dying. I said, is this just really the only option left? You know, it's quite disconcerting to see a nurse praying at the end of your bed.
Yes.
And so I said, look, you know, we must do something. I'm dying. I'm dying and we must do something. And she said, well, there's nothing I can do really for you. And I they say necessity is the mother of invention. I think I had probably the best idea of my life at that point, which was to take all the tubes and mask off my face and to actually open the throttle on the oxygen tank and blast it towards my mouth so that the oxygen would then get into my lungs. And it worked. And I kept myself going like that for about another 8 hours, wow. You know, every couple of minutes. And then finally an air ambulance arrived to take me to a very good hospital in Bogota. But I have no recollection of the journey. But I think, you know, it's one of those things in life where, you know, if you shut your eyes, something deep inside you is telling you don't shut your eyes, because if you fall asleep, you probably won't wake up. And it was a very strong feeling that, you know, that I was close to the end, and that I had to do whatever I could to keep myself going.
Incredibly strong words there from Dan. I'm speechless. And on that note, we'll take a short break and we'll be back to talk further about Dan's experiences and indeed his foundations and the reason for which he and why he's there in Cali at the moment, and we have the opportunity to talk with him. So I am incredibly grateful that he's spending this time to talk to us. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl, and we're taking a short break. We'll be right back. Don't go away, please. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl here in Bogota, talking to Dan Ely, who's down there in Cali at the moment and sharing some incredibly personal experiences of his tragic injury in Leticia in the Amazon down there on New Year's Day 2010. But, you know, he survived it. And that last point, to me, is so poignant, that you had the idea to you know, unplug, disconnect all the tubes that were connected to you and to this rusty old air tank, and that sort of I'm imagining sort of like a, you know, a scuba tank, and that you sort of opened up and then it almost inflated your lungs with. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's more like when you turn the throttle on a gas tank,
yeah,
and it comes out of pressure,
and it just inflated your lungs, right?
Well, I mean, I just put my mouth in the. I asked her to point it towards my mouth. It wasn't actually my mouth wasn't over. I don't think it really inflates your lungs because okay. I mean, there's still air, I suppose, getting into your lungs. But what you need is a blast of compressed air, and I guess it did inflate my lungs, but you know, the relief was just like nothing I've ever experienced in my life.
Yes. And so then you were transported, I guess, were you in the Fundación Santa Fe in Bogota?
No, it's called Clínica del Country.
Oh yeah, and that's where my son was born. So okay, very good.
Yeah. Right. So it's, as you know, it's an excellent hospital.
Yes.
Upon arrival, you know, I was given about 4 hours to live, according to them, and they operated immediately on my neck, which was sort of hanging off its spinal column. I mean, literally, it had toppled to one side. So they put two titanium rods to fix my bones back together in my neck and fix my head effectively back onto the spinal column, which was a very good, successful operation. It doesn't cure a spinal cord injury, I'm afraid. It just fixates the head back onto the column. And then the tube was obviously put into my throat straight away to enable me to breathe. And I was left I was left with a tube in my mouth for about a week. I couldn't speak. I remember people coming in to see me, leaving, crying. And my mum and my sister very quickly arrived from the UK to be with me. And, you know, the first decision I had to make was the doctor had approached my mum and told her the prognosis, which was that I will never walk again, never use my hands, and probably never have any quality of life. And that I'd already had five cardiac arrests from which I'd been resuscitated. And it was suggested that we consider a no resuscitation order. Bearing in mind that you can't keep resuscitating someone. And also in their view, my life would never be a life that I'd be happy with. So, you know, having just 1 week earlier being sort of excited about the adventure of a lifetime, I now found myself having to make a decision about whether I want to let myself live or die. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty tough. Shocking. Yeah. And I remember feeling really just exhausted, and it's just, you know, I couldn't imagine any kind of life ahead of me in that condition. And so I said to my mum and to the doctor, said, you know, let's just let what happens, let's what happen happen. You know, if my heart stops, it stops, and and then maybe it'll start again. And I did have one further cardiac arrest from which I wasn't resuscitated, and my heart started of its own accord after 16 seconds.
Wow. So six cardiac arrests.
Five in total.
Five in total, okay.
So I had four, and the fifth one I wasn't resuscitated from. So I really was that close to the end. And I had this very peaceful, relaxing, loving and spiritual out of body near death experience from which I returned, and I felt all of a sudden much, much calmer and much happier about everything, and really the desire to live had returned.
It took over, the desire.
Yes. I mean, I suddenly felt, you know, just very safe, very, yeah, very peaceful, and that, you know, I'd come back for a reason. And, you know, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I am a spiritual person. And I do feel that, you know, that was a spiritual experience for me, and it was a very strong message to me. And now, in some sense, I can sort of see how and why that might happen.
Wow. I cannot even begin to understand what you've been through and now, but I just like to think that you, as you say, a spiritual person, you're back, and there's now the desire, like, to give back. I mean, this is what you're doing now. What do you say? You have the Dan Ely Foundation.
Yes, that's
right. And it's to, I mean, I'll just read what it is, to support improvements to the lives of Latin American children. I mean, that's what it says on the website. So tell us about it. Tell us how this came about.
Well, yeah, I spent a very difficult year in hospital. I flew back to England in an air ambulance, which was funded through a Facebook campaign, which one of my friends set up.
Incredible.
Again, another extraordinary part of the story is that to get an air ambulance back to the UK, it costs about £60,000. And I'd been working for 2 years as a volunteer and 4 months as a teacher. And anyone who's a teacher knows that I didn't have savings. And you know, what happened next was really something remarkable. That a friend of mine in the UK started a Facebook page, and within the space of 5 weeks, all the money was raised. 8,000 people from 40 different countries raised money to bring me back to the UK, and I still don't know to this day the majority of those people. So
£60,000,
yeah, in 5 weeks. I remember in 1 week it went up £22,000, and I was just thinking, you know, who are these people, and why are they giving to me? It's one of those things that I'll never really be able to understand. But it did show me, you know, the real true best side of human nature, and sure, and it gave me this kind of feeling of being supported and that I could never give up. Very special to go through to experience something like that. I think it's very unusual and very unique to experience such an outpouring of kindness, mm-hmm, and support. I got back to the UK and spent a year kind of recovering from pressure ulcers and rehab. And and then at the end of the year, moved out into a continuing care home, which again was a very difficult part because somehow when you're in hospital, you feel like anyone else when you're lying down in a ward. But then when you're thrown back out into the world as a completely different entity physically, it was very, very disappointing, very sad. And so, I went through another very difficult sort of 3-4 months of trying to kind of get my head around what life was now and what I was going to do and whether I like it or not. I'm alive and I'm going to be alive for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I read a lot, soul searching and reading a lot of philosophy books. And I found the inspiration really to try and start a charity, which is something that I'd worked with street children and youngsters in Central America. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to do it before my accident, but never really had the belief that I could. So all of a sudden, I found myself with just a huge amount of time on my hands, you can sort of redesign your life from scratch. And I thought, okay, I might as well give this a shot because I've got nothing to lose. And the thought of a life indoors watching daytime TV, to me, I might as well be dead if I'm going to spend my life doing that. So anyone who's watched daytime TV in Britain knows what I'm talking about.
Daytime TV anywhere. Daytime TV anywhere is a death sentence. It's
yeah. I think they do it deliberately to get people out and start working. I think so I had this idea and I thought, well, let's just try it out, see what happens. And within a month, I had a team of trustees, six of us. I'd met a partner charity in Colombia through friends in Cali. And we'd spoken on Skype. He and his wife came to visit me. They met my board of trustees, and we immediately felt this strong union of spirit and passion to work towards the same goals. And it's a charity called Fundación Educación para Todos, and they're a very good small charity in Cali that have been working for 20 years. And it's all about giving kids and youngsters not only professional skills and education, but also, values, emotional support. We have psychologists, we have social workers that visit the families. It's quite a comprehensive approach to trying to sort of rehabilitate and bring these marginalized youngsters back into the work environment, but also bring them back into a kind of happy place and give them that belief that I lost and then rediscovered. And perhaps me having been what I've been through and me speaking to them can show them that, life can really seem awful at times, but you can turn it around. And, if I can do it, I know they can do it. Mm-hmm. And then this is what I tell them every, I was just met last week, our sixth group have just started. We've trained 200 youngsters since 2012. We have a very good success rate in terms of our graduates entering employment. About 50%, just over 50%, are now working as assistant accountants in Cali.
Wow!
So it's a really good model. It addresses a lot of their needs. As much as the need to start working. Their value system and the kind of things we take for granted, but perhaps they haven't grown up with the positive role models and good influences. And why should we treat each other with respect? And why is it important to be punctual? And why shouldn't I steal when I have the opportunity to steal? Mm-hmm. And all these things that aren't obvious to someone who hasn't had the benefit of a good upbringing.
Yeah, and then would you say a lot of these children's youngsters, adolescents, they come from broken homes or from very poor backgrounds, humble backgrounds?
Yes. I mean, some of the stories are really powerful. I mean, just I could give you a couple of examples without mentioning any names. There's one of our students, his parents abandoned him when he was pretty much a baby, a toddler, and he grew up in a state orphanage until the age of 18, and then he was quite, you know, kicked out into the real world, and found a friend of a sister or a in-law that he lived with, and we took him into our course. We do have a selection process.
Yeah.
And now he's obviously hit for him. The necessity to start working and earning money is very, very urgent. And if not, you know, you can easily see how kids like this could end up in crime and gangs, because there really is no alternative for them. Another story, which impacted me quite powerfully, and that's just one I heard last week. One of the students on our latest course, her mum suffered a spinal cord injury, much like I did, and she now cares for her mum. So she gets up at 4 a.m, does all her personal care, then comes to our course, studies all day, and then goes home and cares for her mum until 9 o'clock at night, you know, with no support, unfortunately, from the government. But they've scrapped together to buy her a wheelchair, a push wheelchair, mm-hmm. you know, so it's really, really devastating stories, really sad stories, and kids that really need help. That kids, youngsters that in England would probably be doing really well, yeah. But who here risk falling by the wayside and this waste of potential. And I think that's really the saddest thing for me, is that so many youngsters with so much talent and potential don't get the opportunity to ever discover that, because the circumstances aren't there for them to do so. So what we're doing is just one small drop in a very big ocean, but which we're trying to grow and expand, and you know, we do accountancy courses at the moment, assistant accountants, and we also now want to do a marketing courses, because it's something that the companies have told us is also in demand. So we tailor as much as possible our courses to the demands of the local job market. We have a very good relationship with the local business community, and they like our graduates and accept them. So this is important. Also, we have this constant conversation with them, and they tell us, you know, what skills they're looking for, and we go away and try and design courses to match that.
That to me is the most impacting and the most realistic. I mean, it's very inspiring that there's a good two-way conversation there between you and the business community, the foundations and the business community. You know, what is needed? So therefore you can, well, let's say not guarantee a job, but you've definitely you're on the inside track to be able to provide work for these underprivileged children who could possibly otherwise fall into solvent abuse and by the wayside, and of which there are many people, as you say, in Colombia, the big but equally you're doing some, you know, you're out there doing it, and you're seeing a tangible reward, aren't you? I mean, the 50% is a high percentage when you're talking about this type of background.
Yes. Yeah, and I think the key to the success is this close relationship with the business community, and this constant communication, because without that, you know, they tell us they've had a lot of graduates from other programs like SENA, which is the although they may know the skills, they don't have the conduct, the values, they don't know the etiquette, they don't so, you know, it's as if not more important to teach them how to behave at work, to use their initiative, to turn up on time, to be respectful, as it is to actually teach them the trade well. So yeah. we have a strong focus on life skills and a personal development plan. And I think, you know, this communicate, I think where many other charities perhaps fall short is they assume, you know, you can train someone up to be something, but unless you've actually gone to the business community and said, look, is this what you want?
Yeah,
is this going to work? Then they will end up with a qualification but no job.
Yeah, yeah,
and they'll forget it quite quickly. So it is very important, and I think that's the key to our success is that.
Well, you know, my hat is off to you on this one. You know, to go from through your experiences, but to take it to this such an extreme and extremely positive level. Can I ask, you know, when you come down to Cali, because where it's all based, and you're down there and you go and visit and you attend the classes, I know you've attended some of the classes this week indeed, how do the other students respond to you?
It's a good question. I think they're a little bit stunned at first that there's this guy on the other side of the world in a wheelchair who's helping them for you know, to them no apparent reason. It must be very odd. And so I try and explain to them, you know, why I do what I do, how I ended up in Cali, and actually that I've been supported and helped by so many people in so many ways since this happened to me that I feel compelled to give back. It's not something I do out of a duty or a sense of a burden. I just the love and support I've received has been so moving that now to be able to give back is it seems like the only normal thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it's actually what's made me happy again is the ability to participate in people's lives in a way that's beneficial. To see those results is the only reason why I'm sat here is with a smile on my face is because I'm now, you know, now my life has purpose and relevance, and it's a very positive kind of mission that I've embarked on, and it's really now it's the greatest joy of my life doing what I'm doing, and I thank them for giving me that opportunity. So
right, what a lesson in humility listening to you, Dan, and I can only imagine that your presence there, you know, when they see this again, this mono, you know, a white man from the other side of the world there in the class, I mean, I imagine that in itself is part of the huge learning curve that these children, these youngsters have, you know. It's like, you know, someone is out there who cares, someone is out there, you know, because often these are, they're swept away by the wayside. You know, the Colombian state, you know, has its abilities in some sectors, but again, as we say, there are so many children because of the realities in Colombia. But you know, that an Englishman would come over, you know, and do this. I mean, it is inspiring. It is truly inspiring. But I understand that there's another side to your foundation, then you do raise money in the UK too for UK projects.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. That's I was really born out of me wanting to give back to my local community because they were the ones who chiefly raised that money to get me home. And also recognizing that although, you know, I live in a very affluent part of an affluent country, and I'm very fortunate, and I've had all the privileges that, you know, anyone can grow up with in life. There are these pockets of need, and it's really been an eye opener for me to sort of see that even in Godalming there are communities and there are youngsters with actually quite similar family backgrounds. Not the poverty is obviously not as extreme, and their problems are different. It's more of a poverty of hope, and they feel just kind of really demotivated and apathetic, and it's a very different situation to Colombia. But we have supported a local skills training charity, which is much more about manual workshop skills and trades that in England work, like being a carpenter or a mechanic. But in Colombia, you know, it's still considered unskilled labor. So it wouldn't work in Colombia, but we do, like, again, we've adapted to suit the demands of whatever's going on locally. So we've supported this charity for 3 years. We're now supporting another charity, which is NEETS, which is in need of employment, education, training. So they're youngsters that really are like the lowest 1-2% in Surrey, which is the province, the county in which I live, and really trying to sort of knock on their doors and find out what their problems are, and you know, buy them clothes for interviews, buy them secondhand laptops, and we hold a spring benefit concert every year, and this year's concert will be going towards these youngsters.
Fantastic.
So we're very much focused on you know, life skills training and skills training and getting youngsters into a healthy place and getting them into the workplace, and giving them a start.
Inspirational. And is there any chance of an exchange program between the Colombia and the UK?
Well, we currently have our third volunteer who's so with Godalming College. We've had two gap year students come out. We've got a great volunteer working for us who's teaching the younger kids in the FADOOP program. She's called Tessa, and she's doing an absolutely fantastic job. We're really happy with her. And so, you know, this is in terms of Colombians going to England, that hasn't happened yet. That's going to be harder because of basically, you know, finances and the visa situation. We have a very, we have a lot of people very keen on helping and coming out and enjoying Cali at the same time.
Excellent. So as we wind down, give us all the info of how our listeners out there can and possibly get involved and to help.
Well, I mean, in terms of volunteering, people that know about web design, graphic design, that's always very handy. If people want to go down to Cali and work as a teacher for some quite righteous group of unruly kids, then, you know, it is a great experience. It is a really, our volunteers have found it really a really rewarding and special experience. So obviously people with teaching skills and who speak a bit of Spanish, definitely, you know, we would look for a 6-month minimum commitment.
Very good.
Just to make it worthwhile. And if you're in a position to donate, of course, like any charity where we need funds to operate, you can find on our front page, homepage of the website, which is www.danelyfoundation.org. There is a donate now button and you can donate with debit or credit card from anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are so many ways to help. It's not just about money. Volunteering and skills is also something that we have a lot of people that help us with that as well.
Fantastic. So, you know, if you're feeling beneficial or you want to, if you're feeling, you know, a flash or you want to participate in teaching some vivacious children, let's say, in touch with the, you know, through the Dan Ely Foundation website. And
that's right. And just so your listeners know, Richard, there is a contact us page where people can email me directly. So
Excellent. We'll put up all the details, of course, on our Facebook and on Twitter and everything, but we'll spread the word, and I hope and pray that hopefully something, you know, we'll be able to push some more you know, let's say volunteers and maybe some donations towards the project, because what you are doing is, you know, let me say, is really exemplary. And again, like I say, I've been left speechless during a lot of this chat, this interview with you, because, you know, you are sitting there on the other side of the screen, we're on Skype, and you're smiling. You are clearly a happy person in spite of everything that's gone on and changed your life, you know. It's an irreversible change. I mean,
no, thank you. And you know, it's been a pleasure to speak to you, Richard. And you know, it's been the greatest joy of my life. So starting a charity and being able to see it work. So, you know, if I could leave one message for your listeners, is you know, please, life can seem really, really bad and difficult at times, but, you know, never give up on your ability to find true happiness and to be successful at something, because it's there for all of us. I'm absolutely convinced of it.
Well, listen, thank you so much for your time and this effort and these words, these inspirational words. It's been really, you know, a learning curve talking to you here, even over Skype, and hopefully one day I'll be able to get down to Cali and see the projects with my own eyes. If you're ever up in Bogota, of course, you know, you come on through.
I will. Yeah, I do come around. I do go occasionally. I actually go back to visit the doctors and nurses in the Clínica del Country.
Fantastic.
So, but yeah, come down here, you know, come and meet us and meet the youngsters whenever you want, Richard.
Definitely. So thank you again to Dan Ely. And I know that the listeners have enjoyed this show. And well, as I say, you find us on Facebook and you'll find us on Twitter, Columbia Calling. And of course, our website, columbiacallingradio.com. I've been Richard McColl talking to Dan Ely. This has been Columbia Calling. Thank you. Thank you again for listening. We'll be back next week.